So, I'd like to cover, oh, thank you very much. Business class. I'd like to cover three topics, and the first one is the concept of the avatar. We don't get quite as many people as our programs as the movie did, but we do have something to say about that. We have something to say about everything. Because when you think you have knowledge of everything, you become a sort of a know-it-all. So, we're going to speak about the concept of avatar. And then I want to speak specifically about Lord Chaitanya, whose appearance we're celebrating today. And then, somehow I was inspired to end by... I want to touch upon an aspect of God, which is... has a topic which has been perhaps the most controversial aspect of theology, certainly in the history of the intellectual history of Western culture, and to some extent also in Asia, in India, and that is the moral character of God, the nature of God as a moral agent, and is God a perfect moral agent, so on and so forth. Is God simply almighty, or also all good? So, avatar. Avatara is a Sanskrit pronunciation. It's a Sanskrit word composed of two elements, ava. Ava means downward in Sanskrit. Tara is from a Sanskrit root, which means to cross over. So, avatara, literally, without worrying about sounding nice in English, what it literally means is a down-crosser. So, that basically concludes my lecture. Anyway, it's called a down-crosser because the idea is that there is a spiritual realm. That's the good news, that there is something beyond this planet as we know it. There is a spiritual realm, and from the same root, from the same Sanskrit root, which produces the word tara, crossing. And those of you who know the mantras we chant, Prabhupada's pranam mantra, ends with paschati desha tarine, that's the same tara. It means literally one who takes a cross. Well, the idea is there's a spiritual realm, and then there's a material realm, which is distinctly less than the spiritual realm in various ways. And so, for example, in India, a pilgrimage place, a place where you go, a holy place where you go to get in touch with the spiritual, is called a tirtha. This is a very common word. Everyone from India knows this word, tirtha. And so from the same root, it means a crossing. So the idea is the avatar crosses down from the spiritual realm into this world, and not only to Pandora, but actually to other places as well. And so literally, I mean, technically, I forget the guy's name in the movie. Anyway.
Jake, yes.
Technically, I don't want to criticize movies, a nice movie, but technically he wasn't Avatar, unless you take the place he was coming from, that company, or human life in general, to be superior, because the word Avatar literally means not merely laterally moving from one body to another body, but it means actually coming down from a higher position. That's what the word avatar means. But you're still good, pretty good 3D graphics anyway. So the avatar crosses down from the spiritual realm to this realm, and then the tirtha, in a sense, the avatar by coming wherever the avatar lives or teaches or whatever, becomes a tirtha. For example, in Buddhism, there are very famous tirthas like Bodh Gaya, the place where Buddha is said to have achieved his enlightenment, the place where he gave his first teachings, and so on. And in every tradition, I mean, every religion, every spiritual tradition in the world, sooner or later, develops tirthas. They don't mean to call it that. Holy places, almost always associated with the activities of someone who is considered to either have come down from a higher realm, or somehow to channel the higher realm. Somehow a holy place is a crossing. It's a crossing. Also called a ford, like, for example, Oxford, which is now a famous university town, but originally just a place where they took oxen across the river. So that's what a tirtha is. It's a place where you cross upward, and then the person who comes down to teach us and so on is called the avatar, the person who crosses down. That's what the word literally means. So this is a concept, the concept of avatar, the notion that a divine being or an enlightened being or even God actually comes to this world and participates in human affairs, somehow enters within human history in order to transform it. This is a concept which I think without any question received its most serious development in terms of conceptually, philosophically, theologically in India, as in the whole avatar theology, you could say. And even in India, among the various schools of thought and various traditions in India, without question, it is in the Vaishnava tradition that the avatar really became most prominent. In other words, avatars associated with Krishna or Vishnu. In fact, they're the famous Dasha avatars. Dash is just Dasha, Sanskrit 10, English decimal. So the Dasha avatars are the 10 famous avatars of Vishnu. And you can even see historically that other traditions within India, you know, sort of had to keep up with the Dasas, keep up with the, you know, there was a very intense competition or, you know, sort of competing for the hearts and minds of the people in India. And so other traditions tried to come up with their own avatar theologies, and they never really took off. They were somehow kind of contrived. And so it's really in relationship to Krishna and Vishnu, if you study the history of Indian religion, that the avatar became a very powerful and very potent spiritual idea, which really is at the heart of the main spiritual traditions of India. So that's avatar in general. Chaitanya. Well, first let's go to the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita was actually voted a couple of years ago by the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, this international Hindu organization, as the most important book in Hinduism. So the Bhagavad Gita, which Krishna speaks, is the single most influential, the single most important, you could say, sacred text coming from that tradition. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself, specifically in chapter 4, talks about this notion of avatar. There's a discussion of avatar in chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita. And basically what Krishna says is that I am the avatar, although he never worked for that company. But still, so Krishna explains his purpose. Krishna explains his purpose in coming to this world. Actually, John Landa, who produced the movie, is a good friend of some devotees, some friends of mine, and he did say that the reason they made the avatars blue is because of Krishna. And they were very much influenced by this whole thing. So, anyway, they're nice people. So, anyway, Krishna says that the reason I come to this world at all, first of all, when does he come? So I'll just give you those verses and show you how Krishna talks about the avatar, why Krishna himself comes, or other expansions or representatives of Krishna come to this world. Krishna says, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Wait for a moment. It's curtains for the darshan. So, Krishna says that yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Whenever dharma is collapsing, dharma. Boy, we'll never get to the feast. Anyway, there's all these important ideas I want to explain. Dharma is a Sanskrit word which basically means sacred law. I mean, there are many, many meanings of dharma, but that's kind of like the essential meaning of it. It is, okay, to show you how this concept of dharma is not merely an Indian notion. I'm going to give another example of a very similar notion, which was all the rage among sort of intellectual people or educated people in the Greco-Roman world around the time of Jesus. Something, for example, in groups like the Stoics, and that was the notion of logos. The notion of logos. So I'd like to compare logos to Dharma because it's very interesting. I think it sheds some light on what Dharma really means. Logos, of course, from which we have words like logic and so on. The logos was considered to be, in a sense, the logic of the universe. The idea was that God was understood to be the supremely rational being, supremely intelligent, supremely reasonable, and creative. And so within the mind of God is this supreme intelligence, infinite intelligence, called logos. So that when God creates the world, just as if you, let's say, design a house or a submarine or paint a picture, whatever we create, we invest our intelligence in that creation. And so that creation reflects our understanding, our intelligence, and so on. And so the idea here is that because this logos, this supreme intelligence, supreme creative intelligence and logic exists in the mind of God, and therefore it is infused into the universe. So if you look at, for example, you know, of course they couldn't do it back then, maybe, but like really huge blow-ups of snowflakes or water crystals or anything, or all the different astronomical features of the universe. Biology, if you look anywhere into the living self, you look anywhere, you find this infinite logic, this infinite intelligence. And so that was the idea, that the logos is in the mind of God, therefore it's within the universe, it's everywhere within the universe, and we ourselves, being creatures, being creations of God, we also possess this logos within our own consciousness. And so the process of God consciousness or self-realization, in a sense, is to discover that logos within oneself, within the creation, and therefore to connect oneself with the mind of God. So that your consciousness reconnects, which in Latin, of course, is re ligare, religion. It's interesting because the word religion, ligare, like ligament, connection, is the same as the word yoga. So the idea is that by discovering this logos within everything, within yourself, within the creation, ultimately within the mind of God, everything is reconnected. The original unity of existence is reestablished, at least within your own consciousness. One last little point, then I'll get on with the Dharma thing, and that is that because this concept was so popular, and, well, as far as I can see, because it's basically true, this concept was so popular a few thousand years ago during the classical civilization that a sort of a new religious movement that was trying to compete and kind of get their foot in the door, which was the Jesus movement, they were trying to appeal to the educated people of their time. And therefore, apparently in West Turkey, someone wrote a book about Jesus in which this person explicitly tried to appeal to the educated people of his time. He did that by beginning his book with the words, "In the beginning was the Logos," which is translated, "The beginning was the Word." But actually what he said was, "In the beginning was the Logos," because it was an attempt to appeal to educated people of the time, and so on. Anyway, so the word dharma it's a similar notion, the idea that there's a divine structure within the universe, there's a divine law, so that, for example, if you eat properly, there is a dharma of nutrition, there's a dharma of mental health, there is a dharma of social health, how people should treat each other, and so on. There is a dharma of relationships, and so on and so forth. And some dharmas are universal because all living beings have to do certain things in order to have a healthy, reasonable spiritual life. And some dharmas are particular. For example, there's some things that men do or women do or kings or children, whatever. So there's specific dharmas. But in any case, it's sort of like the logos or dharma. And what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita is that when this dharma is is being neglected, when it is waning. In other words, people are ignoring or rejecting the natural way of life for living things, and therefore there's chaos. In Brazil, if any of you, you know you've been to Brazil, they have this really cool sign they put up on all the highways in Brazil. It says, in Portuguese, quem obedece a sinalização evita acidentes, that one who follows the traffic signs avoids accidents. The idea being, it's like in a reasonable place, the traffic laws are made so that if everyone perfectly obeyed every traffic law, in a sense, there wouldn't be any accidents. And so in the same way, there's a divine law, a cosmic order in the universe, so that if every living being follows their dharma, there will be peace, there will be no conflict between creatures. So when this is collapsing, Krishna says, and abhutanama dharmasya, and adharma, the opposite, is rising, then Krishna says, tadatmanam sujamyam, then I come myself to the universe. And the next statement in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, parichanaya sadunam, in order to deliver or rescue, basically good people. The Sanskrit word is sadhu. And so it's sort of come to mean a wandering mendicant or a saintly person, and it can mean that, but the word sadhu also simply means here good people. Just good, decent people who are trying to, you know, do what's right. And vinashaya chudrushkanam, those who are consciously performing evil deeds, they have to be basically taken out of the game. So, and then dharma sansthapanartaya. And then dharma has to be reestablished. So that's the purpose of the avatar, to reestablish these things in the universe. And there are different kinds of avatars, for example. Well, I won't get too technical on this. But suffice it to say that, we always say about 500 years ago, actually 524 years ago, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in this world, and among a growing number of Vaishnavas, the word Vaishnava means those who worship Vishnu or Krishna in different forms, just like the word Shaiva, those who follow Shiva, and so on. So, except that Chaitanya is Krishna. That Krishna says, Sambhavami yuge yuge, I come in every age, and that in this age, Krishna has come to Chaitanya. So that's very important. For those who accept this as a fact, obviously today is a very important day because today is the anniversary of the day that Chaitanya came. So, the process that he gave, the process that Chaitanya offered, there's the notion of Yuga Dharma. Just, there's many different kinds of avatars and different kinds of Dharma, but there is what is called Yuga Dharma, the idea that there are different ages. For example, obviously, on a day like today in Tucson, in winter, you would probably dress differently than you would in summer. Unless you had just, I don't know, some other way of doing things. But most people, so just like at different seasons, we dress differently. We may have different activities. We may swim in the summer, but not in the winter. In certain places, people ski in the winter and obviously not in the summer. So in the same way, there are different, because in different ages, people have different spiritual abilities and the conditions in the world are different. There are different specific dharmas given in different ages to facilitate self-realization. For example, we can observe that there was a time in history when all around the world, whether it's in Europe or in India or Persia or really anywhere, people were performing fire sacrifices, and there was a great attraction for elaborate, technical, sacred fire sacrifices, offering things into fire. And there was a time when that was actually dominant in world religions, and that is, people don't do that so much anymore. And there was a time when people built great cathedrals, and we're kind of not in the cathedral age anymore. So there was a time when people would find God or divine power within fire, and fire being taken as a god in all these ancient civilizations. and sort of a conduit between ourselves and heaven, that somehow when we offer things into the fire being Agni, Agni is the Sanskrit word for fire, or the fire god, from which, of course, we have the English word ignite. So Agni, and then you offer things into the fire, and then Agni transports those things to a higher realm. So Agni was almost, or fire was practically universally seen or understood in ancient civilizations as a channel between earth and higher realms. And then there was a time in India and in Europe when people, sort of the main religious activity was to build huge monolithic structures, cathedrals or some of the great temples of India. People still do that, but it's not central anymore the way it used to be. And so anyway, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught that in this age, which is a very materialistic age, this won't probably shock anyone here, this is an extremely materialistic age, and therefore the process has been made supremely easy. And the process is called Harinam, or chanting or singing or remembering or speaking the names of God. The names of God. Now, if you study world religions, what you'll find is that virtually in all world religions, there is the notion of a holy name, that somehow the name of God or the name of the divine is somehow itself an avatar. In fact, there's the term nam-avatar, the avatar of the name. I'll just give you a few quick examples, just a very, very brief, superficial survey of world religions. If you, one of the most important events in the Old Testament is the construction of a temple in Jerusalem. The first temple, David wanted to build it. Because of some misdeeds, that honor was given to his son Solomon. Anyway, so the first temple in Jerusalem, which really is an extremely important central event in the Old Testament history. Now, if you read the Old Testament, what you'll find, interestingly, is that the Old Testament declares in the sections that talk about the planning of the project, the actual construction of the project, the grand opening, and then remembering the temple and so on. Whenever the temple is talked about, it's emphasized that actually it is a temple built to the name of God. In fact, there's a statement that just as God lives in heaven, the name of God will live in the temple. And so even in ancient Israel, the name of God was conceived as an avatar, as God coming down to this world in the form of the name. You find the same thing in Christianity. The holy name is, of course, a very significant term in Christian theology. You find it in the most popular forms of Buddhism, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. I mean, you find it, It's really all over the place, the idea that the name of, in fact, even in a Socratic Platonic dialogue called the I Forgot. Socrates, of course, Plato using Socrates, they're actually discussing whether a Greek word for an object, because the Greeks were extremely ethnocentric, I mean, to the max. The Greek word for foreigner is also the Greek word for barbarian in ancient Greek. So anyway, they were discussing whether a particular Greek word for something has a special relationship to that object. And of course, ultimately, we find in the Sanskrit teachings is that in the case of God, there is no ontological, there's no difference between God and the name of God, because God is absolute. So God, in fact, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I wanted to talk about Chaitanya, and he was a very celebrated scholar and in his own time. But he and his followers, he had some of the greatest scholars, some of the greatest intellects in India, actually became his disciples, and they wrote all kinds of very important books that really changed the intellectual history of India. That's a whole other topic. It was a very learned movement. But he himself left only 8 verses, and in the second verse, Nam Nam Akari Bahudhan Nija Sarva Shakti, it's a prayer to Krishna in which he says that all of your own power, speaking to God, has actually been invested in your names. So the idea being that, just like, for example, the Old Testament, as God lives in heaven, the name of God lives in the temple. And that's God. That's God living in the temple in the form of his name. So the Hare Krishna movement. So I guess like Mormons say that we're not really, that's not really the name for us. So anyway, we're called the Hare Krishnas. So the idea, though, is that chanting, when you chant the names of God, in any language, this is not sectarian. It's not like my God can beat up your God. It's not on that level. So in any language, it doesn't matter what language you use. It doesn't matter what tradition you're coming from. It's actually sort of, that's sort of irrelevant. If you actually mean, you could almost say anything. And if your real intention is to call on the Supreme Being, then it sort of works. It's like the relationship between parents and children. If the child is crying out for the parents, whatever the child says, the parents know the kid's crying out for the parents. I mean, the mother's not going to say, I'm sorry if you didn't pronounce my name properly. So, now yoga, the whole idea of yoga, of course, the word yoga means connection or link. It comes from the Sanskrit root yunj, which means to connect or link. And we still have in English in words like conjugal or yoke, like to yoke two things together. So the idea is that when we chant the names of God, as I said, in any language, we chant Hare Krishna for all kinds of really interesting reasons because, well, I'll tell you, because... you know, I offered my service to various religions. That's got the best deal here, so. No, we chant Hare Krishna because the word Krishna comes from a Sanskrit root krish, which means to attract. And so krish means to attract. And na is taken as an abbreviation of the popular Sanskrit root nand, as in ananda, which means bliss. Many of you may know that word ananda, which is just nand with the prefix ah. So ananda. So anyway, so the idea is that because Krishna, because God is all attractive, therefore God is the source of all pleasure. And that's directly stated in another verse describing the word Rama, because the Sanskrit root rum, not the Caribbean beverage, but the Sanskrit root, not to be confused. Okay. But it's pronounced the same way. So from the Sanskrit root Ram, you get the word Rama, and which means, grammatically, it means the source of pleasure. Ramante yogino anante. There's a verse which states, Ramante yogino anante. The yogis, which simply means here spiritualists, the yogis enjoy, Ramante, that verb Ram, Ramante, they enjoy anante in the infinite. I mean, just do the math. If I seek pleasure in the finite, my pleasure must be finite. And if I seek pleasure in the infinite, my pleasure will be infinite. So it said the yogis, the spiritualists, seek pleasure in the infinite. Ramante yogino anante, satyanande, in the bliss of truth. For example, if I'm self-centered, if I'm in the bliss of self-centeredness because I think I'm winning, that's not really true. I'm not really the center. I'm actually very tiny. And so that's sort of the bliss of the lie. And therefore, it doesn't last. So the spiritualists or the yogis, they enjoy the infinite in the bliss of the truth, not the lie. The truth is we're actually tiny little parts of God. All of us, every living being. So Ramante yogino anante satyanande chiratmani, in the conscious self. In the conscious self, they enjoy. And iti, therefore, iti Rama padena, thus by the word Rama, aso parang brahma vidhiyate, that absolute truth is named by the word Rama, because Rama is that infinite pleasure. Rama is that source of all bliss. And so this is a very positive notion of God. The word Krishna indicates that God is infinitely attractive, infinitely beautiful. Rama indicates that God is the source of all pleasure. And Hare is the feminine aspect. It's, well, we'll go into all the grammar here, but feminine evocative form of the word. So it's like ladies first. As I say in Italian, le donne hanno sempre la precedenza. That's how they say ladies first in Italian. They need to have more syllables to be satisfied in Italy. So anyway, women always have the precedence. So even in Hare Krishna, it's first an appeal to the feminine aspect of God and then to the masculine. The idea is that this feminine masculine phenomenon, which is really so central to life. It's just, you know, it's hard to get away from it. It's there really are two genders in the world. And so why is that so? Was it just some trick of evolution, just some trick of blind evolution? Or is it that male and female, not even talking about human beings now. I mean, never mind humans. We're just humans. But in a much bigger sense, talking about male and female, and this, when it's done right, this complementarity. Because really, well, as the French say it, you know, vive la différence, long live the difference, you know, male and female. Anyway, it's a French thing. So the idea is that there is this complementarity between male and female. If there were only males in the world, it would be a very, very dull world. And if there are only females, so somehow male and female together, when there is really purity of consciousness, not a male and female lusting after each other, trying to get their hands on each other, or trying to indulge their vanity with each other, but something much, much more serious and much more promising, actually. So the idea is that male and female originally exists in God, in the absolute truth. And so this world, that's the great divide of world religious philosophy. I mean, I obviously can't go into all here, but if you study the philosophical dimension of any world religion, because, you know, there are ritualists, there are simply pious people that perform, you know, whatever, do this or that. And in every tradition, there are people that actually think and come up with very serious philosophical thinking about these things. And so the great divide among those who think deeply in every religious tradition in the world, generally, including Buddhism, I mean, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, certainly in India, the great divide has been how should I put it? I'll try to do this very, very briefly. The impulse, the urge to seek higher consciousness, to seek enlightenment, in every tradition, is based on the discovery that ordinary material life, just, you know, getting up and doing what everybody else does and not thinking about things too much, that's not the highest. That somehow the world, as it just ordinarily presents itself to human creatures, is just an appearance. And that behind that appearance, there's something much more profound and even infinite. And so that discovery in every tradition leads people to seek to transcend just ordinary life and find higher consciousness, find a higher life. And so then once you do that, though, the question is, what do you do with this world? What's the status of this world? Does it just go in the junk pile? Or when you're enlightened, do you somehow see that it was God all along? Or does it not even really exist at all the way we see it? Like, are we radically in illusion so that we've completely misunderstood the world? Or do we basically see the world as it is, there really is a blue sky and green leaves on trees, but there's something much more important about it that we're missing? And so people have debated about the status of the world, and generally, the view that people have about what the world ultimately is from an enlightened point of view has everything to do with what you think God is or isn't. And so the good news here is that the world, while it has to be transcended, at the same time is ultimately a beautiful divine creation. And that we are beautiful divine creations. And therefore this natural phenomenon that male and female tend to gravitate to one another in order to complete themselves and so on, this actually exists eternally and in the absolute truth. And the only problem here is, as they say, the battle of the sexes, that's an old term, the only problem is people just don't do it right, in the sense they don't do it in pure consciousness. So Chaitanya is the ultimate avatar to resolve all sort of gender conflicts, because Chaitanya, this incarnation of Chaitanya, is actually Radha and Krishna, the male and the female, together in a single avatar. The idea is that if you think about it, in a healthy relationship, let's say between male and female, there is a oneness. It's like you have, let's say here's a male, here's a female, and they come together. There's a sense in which there were two individuals, and now there is a new third thing, which is a couple. A couple. And there's a real sense in which it is a thing. It is a single new reality. It is a couple. And yet at the same time, as we know, if the two people really lose each other, then that's not healthy either. It's called codependence or whatever. And so in a healthy relationship, there is a oneness, and there is also individual integrity. And it's interesting because this sort of common understanding of a healthy relationship is also a healthy relationship with God. There is a oneness with God, but it's not simply a codependence. There is a oneness with God, and yet we have our individual integrity, and God has God's individual integrity. And even between the male and female aspect of God, there's the same thing, oneness, and yet female and male integrity. And so it's quite interesting. So that's the incarnation of Chaitanya. That's the incarnation of Chaitanya. And as far as the practical application, you have this incredible process where the only moving part is your tongue. And if you're into zero moving parts, of course you could just think the name, then of course you have probably something going on neurologically, but I mean, it's free, you can take it across borders without paying duties, and it doesn't weigh anything. And the idea is that you have within your grasp, you have within your hand, infinite power and infinite knowledge. You have everything within your hand because you have the name of God. And again, we chant Hare Krishna, if for some reason some other name strikes your fancy, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what language, it doesn't matter what tradition, because you just have to have the right intention. You are intending to call for that supreme, infinitely beautiful being. And so as soon as we do that, we are immediately in a state of yoga. And that's great. Like if you're stuck in traffic, or someone just broke your heart, or someone, you know, broke your heart by coming back to you. It's like whatever is happening in your life. Whatever is happening in your life, whatever situation you're in health and in illness and in you have this unconditional, this absolute power that you can access immediately, place yourself in the state of yoga and be directly connected to the spiritual realm. And it's actually by that connection that our consciousness becomes purified. Our consciousness becomes purified. In America, there's a long, glorious tradition in America of manufacturing detergents with secret cleansing agents that always start with the letter X for some reason. But anyway, that's... So, the secret cleansing agent, it's like if you want to purify your soul or your consciousness, because if our body is sick, if our body is just really ill, it just doesn't feel good. You know, whatever you do, it's just your body just doesn't feel good. And then when you're healthy, your body feels great just because it's healthy. So in the same way, when the mind is healthy, the mind feels great. And when the soul is healthy, the soul feels great. When consciousness is healthy, then it becomes transparent. Consciousness is naturally transparent. If our consciousness is not transparent, if we're not seeing everything in the universe as it really is, it means we have contaminated consciousness. Like if there's water which is not transparent, it's not pure water. Pure water is perfectly transparent. And pure consciousness is perfectly transparent. So by bringing your consciousness into direct touch with the supreme purity, the supreme pure consciousness through this chanting, your consciousness becomes cleansed. And when your consciousness becomes pure, you will be always in a state of bliss, in a state of enlightenment, just because that's who you are. It's just a question of remembering who we really are and restoring consciousness to its original pure state. It's like, I mean, in Mexico, there's kind of a joke in Mexico City that because it's a, like 6,900 feet up, and it used to be called La Región Más Transparente del Aire, the region with the most transparent air, because it used to be a wonderland, Mexico, until it became the most polluted city in the world. And so it's really, you know, sometimes like when it rains and it just clears up, it's really spectacular. All these big mountains around there. And so in the same way, when consciousness becomes cleansed, you will realize that you are living in like an infinite wonderland. There's like unimaginable beauty and bliss everywhere, within yourself, outside of yourself. It's just a question of clearing consciousness. And of course, you realize your relationship with God, and everybody's happy. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to teach all those things. And anyway, I will not go on forever. So any questions on these points before we end? I mean, there's a million things to say, but not tonight. Yes?
Well, you were talking about male and female, and you talked about codependency, and you talked about Lord Chaitanya being male and female, or Radha and Krishna. So if within Lord Chaitanya, he doesn't have codependency between, for lack of better words, his Radha and Krishna, if he doesn't have codependency, how does that show up?
I'll just wait a second. Interesting. In other words, how does it manifest? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, because you said a lot of things. You talked about male, female, codependency, Lord Chaitanya, the male and female.
Yeah.
So how does the codependency relate to
Well, if we study family? If we study Radha Krishna Leela, if we study the activities of Radha and Krishna, and there are many books about this, we find that it's a, I would say, perfectly healthy relationship.
In what way? How can you give a couple examples?
In terms of the autonomy and dignity of both parties, the unlimited love each one has for the other, and the purity of motive, the purity of understanding. Two perfect persons who are one and different. I mean, spiritually perfect persons. It's a very good question, and probably deserves a much longer answer, but I think that's the basic point. So we're going to end here, so I don't get in trouble. And thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Maharaj, very much. That was a very enlightening.